This episode is sponsored by Interactive Brokers. And here's a question for you. Will the U.S. Consumer Price Index exceed 2.4% in March 2025? Or will the year-over-year change in the U.S. Producer Price Index exceed 3% in February 2025? You could trade your predictions at Interactive Brokers. Just answer yes or no. If you agree, buy yes. If you don't, buy no. Correct predictions earn $1, and incorrect predictions, well, they settle at zero. IBKR Forecast Trader lets you use exchange-listed forecast contracts to trade your opinion on yes or no questions on political, economic, and climate indicators. Plus, you'll earn 3.83% APY on your investment with an interest-like incentive coupon. And you'll get $3 when you start trading forecast contracts. Go to ibkr.com/forecast to get started today. Because the best informed investors choose Interactive Brokers. Forecast contracts are not suitable for all investors. Restrictions apply.
The Disciplined Investor is all about you, your money, and the markets. Sit back and get ready for this edition of the Disciplined Investor Podcast.
This episode of The Disciplined Investor is sponsored by Horowitz & Company. If you're looking for a portfolio manager, look no further. Horowitz & Company. From seed through harvest, cultivating financial success.
The tariff kid. Tariff on, tariff off. U.S. manufacturing turns the corner, and a quick check on earnings and some thoughts on the economy. And our guest today, Danielle DiMartino Booth. She's the Fed watcher. All this and much more on episode number 907 of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Welcome to another great episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. I'm Andrew Horowitz. I'm the founder of Horowitz & Company. And yes, what we do is investing. We invest for clients. We spend time looking at the outlook, what's going on around the world now and into the future, and make our best judgment about where, in fact, we should be investing. And we do that through equities and ETFs and mutual funds and all sorts of different things for you. So if you're interested, go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and just click on the contact us and we'll figure a way to get together and see what you're doing and how we can help. Well, today I want to talk about a couple of different things. I want to talk about the earnings outlook. I want to talk about what is going on and some of the things around the world. Let's talk about and get quickly through this because I do want to get to our guest as well today. Some notes that I was reading this week, some really interesting things that popped up about the earnings season because things, generally speaking, are pretty good. No complaints from me as to what is going on in totality, the big picture when it comes to earnings season. Yeah, there's some problems in certain areas, but when we look at what FactSet Research has put together to date, 36% of the companies that are inside the S&P 500 have actually disclosed their fourth quarter earnings already. And 77%, which is the number that we always look at, 75, 78, 79, 77% of them have reported actual earnings per share that exceeded the average EPS estimate. Well, that's good. That's why you're seeing such great results once a company has actually reported. And that particular 77% is right along with the five-year average, a little higher than the 10-year average. So that's good. That's what we've been seeing. 77% seems to be the number. Now, companies are generally performing well during earnings season. We know that. And they're either, you know, meeting or beating estimates. And the other thing that we do notice that the economic situation is relatively favorable and improving. We saw some names like Palantir come out, a company that we own for our clients, a key holding in the trading side of our TDI managed growth strategy, do amazing, right? After the close last Monday, the company reported a stellar, I mean, just an amazing earnings and outlook report that took the stock to 52-week highs, all-time new highs. CEO Alex Karp came out and explained that much of the success, what was going on, is from internal organic growth, very healthy demand from the company's AI programs. And that's what we're seeing overall. And despite some of the recent positive developments that are seeing from companies like a Palantir, and maybe even, I mean, Google did come in a bit. We own that as well. And that was not as favorable with their outlook, but with the spend that we're seeing, the $40 billion, $30 billion, $10 billion, $40, $50 billion, $60 billion, you know, all these numbers that are going on. Amazon saying, I think it's $100 billion that Amazon talked about, in a once-in-a-lifetime opportunity to garner this AI thing, to really develop the next gen of what is going to be the compute and the opportunity for artificial intelligence and computing for the next generations to come. Amazing numbers. And with all the positive catalysts that we're seeing, there's also a lot of things that we're seeing that are concerned about some of the potential risks that are associated with the policy. And I dare say the process in Washington, it's erratic. This policy-making approach where we just, you know, sign and then ask questions later, where we just put out some ideas that we think are going to be great and then come up with a plan sometime in the future. That approach is what we saw in the last Trump presidency. And okay, it worked out well because at the end of the day, Trump reduced taxes successfully with congressional approval. And that really what was the driver on keeping corporate profits and individual profits, you know, for you and I, higher. And our net take home was better and companies were able to do a great job at the overall opportunities that they had. Now, this I'll call it this erratic policymaking approach. The problem I have with it is it could eventually, if it keeps going, and it's not just, oh, you know, it's a negotiation tactic, or, you know, oh, it's just the way it is. We keep on getting this level of strange things happening could in fact undermine investor confidence, which is precisely what is occurring just weeks into this presidency. You know, we have tariffs imposed and then delayed. We have threats, we have sanctions, government agencies being shut down without much warning, and then, you know, having to have judges come in and spark it back up, and people being let go voluntarily and holding up. And as investors, we, you and I, we need to look beyond the immediate turmoil, right? We need to look about what's going up and what will, in fact, shake up markets and create volatility. These are the kinds of things that are going to create that kind of volatility in the near term. But we need to look at those from the eye and the standpoint of where are the the potential opportunities, right? The benefits to us. And as we're looking at this, we have to look out of the corner of our eye and ask a question. Why is gold doing so well? I mean, gold hit an all-time high, close to 2,900 last week. Crypto, what's going on there? Put that into the same discussion as well. We saw it really move up, but we're going to hold that thought for a second because I have some comments and thoughts on what happened over the last 2 weeks with crypto. But you look at the gold chart, steady as she goes, clear uptrend, smooth and confirmed. And why is that happening? Why are people seeking hard assets and gold? Is it because the dollar is coming down? No. Is it because there is some kind of, a earnings announcement that came out about gold? Well, obviously not. It's because of geopolitical tensions, threats of trade wars, and I guess it would be also general fear of uncertainty. That last word, that last comment is always something we look at when we think about investor sentiment, which came out, by the way, on Friday, much lower, 67 on the University of Michigan number versus a 71 last and a 71 expected. That is a lower amount of overall investor confidence that is coming out, consumer confidence. Uncertainty, that word, it's sometimes just an emotion, an idea. But as we know, we have the Trump art of the trade is to create uncertainty, keep the partners off balance. And look at what's going on with the tariffs. I mean, look at Mr. Miyagi. Remember him? Remember that movie? His sidekick, Daniel-san, his student from The Karate Kid. That's what's going on with tariffs. Daniel, played by Ralph Macchio, right? He was trained by Mr. Miyagi, and he said to him, "Daniel-san, you need to wash and wax the car." And he's like, "Well, Mr. Miyagi, what do I have to do that for? What is that about my training for karate?" "Well, Mr., you will do this, and you'll do it with these hand movements. And remember the very famous wax on, wax off. Wax on, wax off. That's what we have today with Trump-san. Tariff on, tariff off, tariff on, tariff off. We get a tariff that gets put on, and then a phone call later, poof, it's gone. Monday, we came into the markets, and everybody was in a tizzy as the blanket tariffs were posed on both Canada and Mexico starting the next day on Tuesday. Why did they do it on a Tuesday? They threatened it on Friday. They said it's definitely going to happen. Over the weekend, it's going to be imposed. It was imposed. Monday morning, we work in. Everybody's upset. The Mexican markets are down 4 or 5%. Here, we're down 600-700 points on the Dow and 2% on the NASDAQ. Well, by 10 o'clock in the morning, 30 minutes into the regular trading, there's an announcement. President Trump and Mexican President Sheinbaum had a call, and tariffs are going to be postponed for 30 days. Huh. Interesting. And then you know what? Same exact thing happened with Canada. Now, why couldn't we negotiate and talk with them and have this gone on and say, tariffs will be imposed in 30 days if there is no progress made versus this? Why do we need to have all this upheaval? And that's what it is. Now, many of you that are, you know, big supporters are going to say, "Well, that's how he does it. That's the art of the trade. That's what goes on." Really? Seriously? I'm not talking politically here. You know that. That's not what this is. So get that out of your mind. If you're going to turn this off right now, stop. We're not talking politics. We're talking markets. We got to look through some of this. That's my point. We got to look through all of this. Because we got to know that over the next 4 years, we may have hastily imposed and easily swayed confusion, uncertainty. Now, no wonder gold is at an all-time high. People are looking to get hard asset exposure with this kind of nonsense going on. But we have to realize that, yeah, President Trump will do things and back off without much thought of either side. Now, we have to look at things like Bitcoin and crypto in this whole environment. I mean, they're supposed to be the next digital gold, right? Isn't that the whole promise of what was going on? And yes, I know, one of the greatest assets that ever moved and all that. But when we look at Bitcoin, Bitcoin was down over the weekend simply following risk assets. So there's that, right? One more thing. We're seeing companies talking about price increases. So we have Bitcoin that's really not a store of value or a alternative asset for necessarily protecting us from market fears, because that we could see that didn't happen, right? At the same time, we look at what is going on with companies and the reality of where we are. We're going to get into this discussion a little bit more with our guest, Danielle DiMartino Booth, because she's the Fed watcher and knows all about this. But in my opinion, and I'll ask her about this, we have these tariffs that are hitting China. And it's going to eventually push up prices for consumers. We're also already seeing companies like Mattel and a few others saying, you know, hey, 20% of our goods come from China, and you know, we're going to have to do a pricing increase. That's what happened. So let's not be naive, any of us, to believe that the Fed cuts rates. We're going to be 4, 5, 6 of them in the near future. If that happens, things are going off the rails, my friends. That's not what we want to look at. We want an economy that is growing steadily and well, reduction of the deficit, reduction of the debt, maybe a policy that is confidence building, not one that is going to be so crazy and quick thought out without the long term being considered. None of this wax on, wax off stuff. I'm not buying that that is a negotiation tactic. I'm buying that it was an easily swayed situation, not well thought out and put on. And I don't believe that, well, I believe now that Mexico and Canada are going to be like, well, if we could just postpone it for a while more, Just keep on giving a little bit, then postpone a little bit more. And who wins with that? So here's the deal. I think here we are, beginning of February 2025. And in this circumstance, whether we have President Miyagi doing the wax on, wax off thing, or whether or not we get some calm, we have to understand as investors that here we are looking at what? Well, the uncertainty. Okay, put that aside. What we really want to focus in on is the economic outlook and through some of this uncertainty, right? Some of these things that just are going to be political sound bites and some things that are going to come and go. But what is the thing that will be enduring? It's earnings. Now, a lot of companies are starting to lay off already. We know that. We're seeing that come on, and they're doing cost cutting to keep their earnings growing. They're doing a lot of buybacks to ensure that they are going to have a significant amount of overall consistency. We're seeing a lot of companies spending a lot of money on CapEx, and that does very good for certain other companies. And we're seeing things like an AMD, for example. AMD came out with earnings, and we knew that AMD was pie in the sky with this whole AI thing. They did not have what it takes, and they don't. Stock down 8% on just what I thought was miserable outlook at earnings, really not telling us anything. The whole idea of getting in and getting advanced ahead of the whole AI, they're not there yet. Not ready for prime time. And we see other companies that are struggling as well in the area that they did make promise and people invested, and the promise is not coming to fruition at this point. Other companies, on the other hand, are going to benefit greatly. Amazon came out with their earnings, and you know their numbers were a little bit shy in a few different areas and right on in others. And I think that they're still in the big picture. I mean, it's close to an all-time high still, but doing very well. On the other hand, some of the companies we do own and we like are the beneficiaries of some of this build-out that will be continuing. Even with the DeepSeek, you look at what's happening with a Microsoft, you look at what's happening with like a Google and Oracle, and what do they need? What is the thing they need? Well, they need more rack space. They're out, right? They're out of ability to have enough storage capability and cloud for the next generation. And they, when they need to build that, what's going to happen? Well, they need energy. How's that going to happen? That's where I come in with the SMR, the small modular reactors, as well as some of the other companies like a GE Vernova or looking at a company like Constellation Energy and those areas for maybe what could be the next generation of clean energy, new clear energy. Have you heard of that new clear energy? If we get rid of the word nuclear, just go with new clear. I think it's going to be a much better thing. So here we are again in a situation where there's a lot of uncertainty, and what's going to happen with rates is going to be a big issue as well, because the Fed has come out, given us some thought, which I guess is a great segue into our next segment here. Before we do that, I want to talk about, just for a moment, Interactive Brokers again, because don't be fooled by this zero commission on crypto assets and trades, right? This idea where some brokers add a spread to the price you pay, but they're really charging you zero. It's not really zero. But at Interactive Brokers, there are no hidden spreads, and you'll pay much less than you would pay at, let's say, Gemini or Robinhood or even Fidelity. Keep more in your pocket and trade crypto for less coin at Interactive Brokers. Now, trading cryptocurrencies involves risk and is only for the individuals with high risk tolerance and the financial ability to sustain losses. Compare other brokers' fees and see how much you can save at ibkr.com/crypto. Good stuff right there. Well, let's bring in our guest. Let me tell you who we have on. We have Danielle DiMartino Booth. She is CEO and chief strategist at QI Research. It's a research and analytics firm. And she set out to launch what she calls a research revolution, redefining how market intelligence is conceived and delivered to guide portfolio managers and promote financial literacy. That's a big thing for her. Financial literacy is really important. Now, to build QI, she brought together a core team of investing veterans to analyze the trends and provide critical analysis on what is driving the markets, both in the United States and globally. Since the inception in 2015, commentary and data from DeMartino boost the Daily Feather, which is what they write there. The Weekly Quill have appeared in other financial sources such as Bloomberg, CNBC, Fox Business. The list goes on, Wall Street Journal, Seeking Alpha, just blah, blah, blah. It's a long, long, long list, which is great. Now, prior to QI research, Danielle, she spent 9 years at the Federal Reserve Bank of Dallas, and she served as advisor to President Richard Fisher throughout the financial crisis until his retirement in 2015. Now, her work at the Fed focused on financial stability and the efficiency and efficacy of unconventional monetary policies. So let's get right to our guest today with Danielle DeMartino Booth. Danielle, how are you?
I'm great, thank you. How are you?
I'm pretty good. It's you and I have talked offline about the incredible flow of news that has turned into a Trump fest.
It is a Trump-a-thon.
Trump-a-thon. Okay, there you go. I started out the show talking about the tariff kid. You know, you remember the Karate Kid where we had Mr. Miyagi talking to Daniel-san and saying, wax on, wax off? Well, this is tariff on, tariff off. And you know, this rule on, this rule off. It seems the old days used to be called waffling.
Well, I mean, waffling's not a violent enough term. So
burnt pancakes.
It's like watching speed tennis or something.
Yeah, that's a good point. It is. It's speed tennis at two times the speed.
Yep.
Exactly. Let's talk about some of the things that are going on, because I know that you track all the information that's going on with economics, et cetera. You know, you had talked about something that is termed entrenched joblessness and what is going on right now in a world that seems that, you know, the economies around the world, from the outward appearance, without digging down too deep, it's like, all right, things are okay. You know, things are generally okay. Everything's fine. No, nothing's breaking per se. But what's going on with the jobless situation?
Well, you know, it was validating to hear Federal Reserve Chair Powell reiterate what I've been saying when he was at the podium recently. And his message was, if you have a job, don't lose your job.
Ah.
And that's because, you know, the median time of people being out of work is 10.4 weeks. The average is much higher. The number of individuals who've been out of work for 27 weeks or more is deep in recessionary territory. Wage growth seems to have been arrested. Job openings really aren't where they need to be. And the rest of the world is on its back foot as well. So there's very little support coming from where we might find, you know, demand overseas. It's just, if you have a job, don't lose a job.
So is this the culmination of all the slowing that the Fed has tried to do over the last year or so, 2 years, or is this something else that's going on? Because it seems like, you know, when you look at most of the things, like even manufacturing, right? Manufacturing was in a 26-month swoon. It was in contractionary territory, finally reached over. The ISM came over the top this week, earlier this week, and went into expansion territory. But then there's a question, right? There's a big asterisk on that. Why? And I think you were talking about how there may be some reasons why manufacturing actually ticked up just this last period.
Well, there was a lot of buying ahead of time. And if we were going to see follow through to that, we would not have seen a continued decline in backlogs. But we did. And so, in other words, it's fine that you had a spurt of buying, just kind of this impulse to let's get ahead of the potential tariffs that have now not manifested. But inventories are higher than where they should be, which means people are now sitting on inventory that they bought in advance that they don't have demand for, and they don't have the order backlog to fulfill any kind of pent-up demand. And that really is kind of your telltale. In addition to that, you know, as extraordinary as 2024 was in terms of bankruptcies, boy, we have not skipped a beat. going into 2024. There were 48 bankruptcies of companies with kind of a million or more in liabilities. I think four of them were multi-billion-dollar companies.
You're talking about 25?
This is January. This is
just
January.
Yeah, that's what I'm saying. Last month.
And then in February, we've had, I'm calling it the one a day phenomenon. We've had one bankruptcy of a company with 50 million or more in liabilities every single day in the first six days of February. This is
What is that about? What's happening?
Well, you pinned the tail on the donkey. You said, is this kind of, are we still seeing kind of the backlash from higher for longer Fed policy? And my answer would be absolutely yes, we are. Because the Fed's not aggressively lowering interest rates, which means that when push comes to shove, and if companies don't have financing at the right rate, they're going out of business.
So is this the continuation of a slowdown that's going to persist for a while, and why the Fed tried to get ahead of it by actually reducing rates, when in fact their two mandates, their two basic mandates, which was employment, stable prices and employment, but yet stable prices was not stabilized yet. But they felt, and employment was fine, by the way, at 4.1% or so, 4.2%, give it a round number, where it was. Is that why they started doing it? Because they started to see the signs that there was real problems building up?
Yes, but there have been a lot of cross currents, and the market has been, you know, adamant in saying inflation is going to be the bigger problem. Well, guess what? It's not. And we're seeing inflation continue to cool. And the Fed is going to, in my view, at least, the Fed's going to be back footed again and have to play catch up with rate cuts again.
So you think that the probability of rate cuts, from what you're saying here, you think the probability of rate cuts is higher than no rate cuts into, let's just say, through 2025?
Yes, absolutely.
Do you think they have to be aggressive, or are they just talking about another two at the end of the year, which is where I think it's August and September. I think it's August where the first one they have penciled in as a possibility. You think it's going to be a lot more than that?
Well, now we've got a 46% probability, which is just about at that 50% line for a June rate cut. And we've got a lot of labor market data in front of us. And we're just now starting to see how much the Department of Government Efficiency, how efficient it might be.
That's an interesting thing, because they went from a true trillion down to 1 trillion. And now they're just doing wholesale cuts, which we don't know, by the way, if it's going to be good for the country, maybe fine for the balance sheets, right? The cash flow. My guess, by the way, side note, is that Elon Musk one of these days will say, you know what? I know we said 2 trillion, but 1 trillion was more like it. The reality is, I think we could really do 420 billion, trying to get that whole 420 thing going. Yeah, well, he likes that. He likes to talk about pot.
Yes, he does. But even that would be highly disruptive when you consider the number of displaced employees that you're talking about. And you've already got a private sector that has told you, you know, we continue to, you know, right now wage growth is running at like 4.5%, but yet withholding is running at about 2% withholding taxes. So the only thing that can bridge that divide between the two is people being fired. You're actually counting fewer people. And that's why I think one of the reasons I stick with this mantra of if you have a job, don't lose it. It's because companies are being so stealthy in the way they're reducing headcount. They know with social media, you know, the minute they announce a layoff, it's going to go all over LinkedIn and TikTok, and people are going to, you know, basically film human resources as they fire them, so that, you know, so companies have become very precautionary in just saying, you know what, if you don't perform, then you're just going to lose your job.
It's funny that you mentioned that. I literally was just having a conversation with a client who was just let go from a company, major company, that he worked for 19 years. And the reason, performance-based. And the fact was that over the last year, they switched their whole performance characteristic of what he would be benchmarked against never really filled him into what that was. And a year later said, you know what? We're laying off X amount of people and you're one of them.
Yep.
And he was shocked.
Exactly.
And no severance.
No severance.
And Monday, thank you very much. You don't pack your bags because in this case he was remote, but thank you very much. We're going to cut you off and have a nice day.
You know, I don't think people have a good appreciation for when a big company takes a drastic move and the fact that they're resetting the benchmark for all of their competitors. So whether you're talking about whether you're talking about JP Morgan saying you're back in the office 5 days a week, or if it's Amazon introducing performance improvement plans, which you just described as a way to get rid of employees but not have to pay them severance. When you have huge companies like JP Morgan and like Amazon set the precedent, then you're going to have a bunch of people follow them mm-hmm. in their wake.
Right, because now it's acceptable. It's palatable. Oh, well, they did it. If they did it, we could do it too. I mean, that's how they look.
Well, and it's also viewed as being a way to stay competitive. You know, if they're going to cut their cost structure, we've got to cut our cost structure in order to remain competitive. And meanwhile, in the background, you know, you've got repossessions that are going through the roof, car repossessions. You've got credit card delinquencies that are, you know, the percentage of people paying their credit cards on time is like a 13-year low. And you've got student loans about to hit some of the higher income earning individuals in America. So you've got households that cannot afford to lose their jobs. And yet this is going on in the background.
You don't sound very bullish on the economic outlook.
I'm not bullish on the economic outlook. But, you know, look, one of the headlines that I read a few days ago says Amazon war on bloat alienates workers and pleases Wall Street.
Yeah, well, that's of course. How many times have you heard about a company that missed on their revenues doing a buyback and missed on their earnings, but also doing a headcount cut and the stock goes up?
Oh, yeah.
So it's all about earnings at the end of the day. It's not, you know, that's what it is. And they don't, and Wall Street doesn't care how you get there for the most part.
That's why they call it the bottom line.
Yeah, that's correct. That is the bottom. So now, do you think that as a Fed watcher, right, as a economist and a person who their business is all about making sure you get it right as best as possible and making calls, right? That's what you do, right? You have to parse through all this data and then distill it down to something that makes sense that is actually potentially actionable, right? From an investment standpoint, is that fair?
That's fair.
Okay. So you've been a vocal critic, or have you been vocal? Let's say not critic. You've been vocal about the Fed's missteps in monetary policy, right? Do you think that them not reducing rates more is a significant policy error, or is there something they should be looking to do maybe differently?
I think they are right now leaving a lot of Americans behind. And, you know, every time Jay Powell takes the podium, he says, we're making monetary policy for everybody in the U.S. economy. Well, that's not true when credit card rates are, you know, still in the upper 20% range. So clearly, you know, if you're some great big corporate borrower, you're having no trouble at all borrowing money. But that's not the case if you're Joe Q, Jane Q worker. Mm-hmm. And your borrowing costs are still very prohibitively high. As far as you're concerned, not that you could put these words together, because you spend your time worrying about putting food on the table, not getting down Federal Reserve monetary policy jargon. But as far as you're concerned, monetary policy remains restrictive because your borrowing costs remain high.
And your employer
just went out of business or declared bankruptcy. And, you know, there were 2,142 stores closed in America in January. Those are people.
And then on top of it, if you also have the situation where while inflation is coming down per se, the fact is the prices are not. You know, prices are, inflation is not what you actually spend money on. You spend money on products. You pay a price. That price is not slowing down. It is just not going up as fast. That has been, listen, that's been the story you and I have talked about for the last year and a half.
I call it the latent inflation.
Latent inflation.
It's still there. It's a carryover from years of inflation running at a high level. So it's still expensive compared to what it was in 2019, appreciably more so, 20% more so, even though the rate of inflation is coming down. And, you know, as I said, market-based core PCE, and it's a fancy way of saying, we're just going to look at where market price is right now. And Chair Powell and his Chief Lieutenant Christopher Waller have both said, you know, this imputation of owner's equivalent rent is a bunch of hooey. If you replace that with where new rents are, that they're running at a much lower rate. In fact, the Cleveland Fed has a metric out that's called the New Rent Tenant Index. And it flipped from a positive 1.4% in the third quarter of 2024 to a negative 2.6% in the fourth quarter of 2024. Again, you substitute that in for this arcane imputation of owner's equivalent rent into this market-based metric, and you get to 1.25%. So the difficult thing for households to hear is that the Fed has a disinflation problem on its hands and therefore needs to lower interest rates to address that. And yet they're still dealing with higher prices than what they were a few years ago. But again, the fact that prices are not rising at near the rate that they were, 1.25% year over year, that is indicative of companies losing pricing power. And that's a reflection of the economy.
Right. Well, the problem is that there's a ceiling. There's a limit to how much people can spend, right? There's only so much money that a consumer has and how they're going to dole it out. And if you have a situation where oil prices are really high, now, of course, the Fed looks at their core inflation. Let's make sure everybody is very up on this. Core inflation excludes food and energy. Because I don't know about you, Danielle and I don't eat and we do not consume any energy for any kind of transportation or heating. So we live in a world of core PCE, right? Just like everybody else?
Of course we don't. Of course we don't. And there's this whole bird flu thing, you know, when it was just a few chickens, there wasn't this violent reaction, but then you started to see it spread to the cattle. And then at the end of 2024, you actually had a human being lose their lives. So we got really serious going into 2025 about just culling the ranks of chickens all across the country. Egg prices go up. That angers people tremendously. Give it 16 weeks, though, and we're going to have a whole bunch more chickens. But again, it doesn't matter. It matters what you're seeing at the grocery store on a day-to-day basis that inflames your anger.
Yeah. It's interesting because the eggs don't only impact eggs. There are tons of other products that contain eggs, or when you go to a restaurant, they include eggs in the recipe, and that raises the price as well. Mayonnaise is a classic example.
Well, you had Waffle House come out and say, we're going to have to charge you 50 cents per more per egg. I mean, that's a big deal.
Yep. So when we look at the Fed right now and the idea that the current administration believes that they're a lot smarter than the Fed, and even though that Powell has some time on his reign, and he said he's not resigning and he can't get fired. That's what Powell said. Whether he does or not is another story in the future. But nonetheless, if he stays on as he is, he has been under the pressure before of a president, particularly President Trump back in the day, that pressured or tried to pressure him into moving. Now, these days, just last week, the new U.S. Treasury Secretary, Bessert, and he was talking about how, well, we're not going to really pressure the Fed on the front end of the curve. We're really trying to reduce down the cost on the 10-year. What's that all about?
Well, what they're saying is we want long-term borrowing costs to come down because that's what filters through to mortgage rates and other borrowing rates. So he said, but the Fed doesn't control the long end of the curve.
Nobody controls it besides the investors, right?
True.
So I don't know how they're expecting to do that. They're going to put an executive order on a 10-year? Cap on a 10-year?
Well, that certainly happened in the aftermath of World War II. But that was an extraordinary time. And you'd like to think that that's not going to be repeated.
That's actually what Japan did also. Japan had caps on rates, and they had price fixing, if you will, on that. And that is supposed to be anti-capitalistic, right? But yet they're talking about doing this. And do you think that there's going, do you think Powell's going to finish his term?
Oh, yes, I do. That I do. Is Powell going to get from February of 2025 to May of 2026, just a little bit more than a year from now? Yes, he is.
And he's going to make a point of staying, regardless of the pressure from above.
He can make a point of staying because of Supreme Court precedent that suggests the Federal Reserve Board can vote to keep him in place, which they would do even if they didn't want him to stay in place because they wouldn't want to set the precedent until the Supreme Court rules. That is an old Supreme Court precedent that goes back to when FDR was in office, and FDR fired the head of a federal agency and was found to have been outside of his purview in doing so, which I promise you Trump knows.
And now,
they can make his life a lot harder.
Sure.
They can make the next 14 months of his life feel like the longest 14 months ever, like dog years. But I think Treasury Secretary Scott Bessent understands and is kind of a calmer voice that it can't be done. But look, there's a chair coming open on the Federal Reserve Board in January. So Trump is going to replace that individual. Trump is going to replace whoever replaces Powell. So there still will be a remaking of the Federal Reserve Board under Trump, just based on who's leaving when.
Mm-hmm.
Michael Barr has actually said he's going to stay out his 14-year term, but there will be opportunities for him to reshape the Federal Reserve.
So with all that's going on, one of the biggest problems that I seem to come across daily and scratch my head about is, okay, so we have these tariffs. Whether they stay on, whether they stay off, whether they're actually good or bad. Let's leave that aside for one second. Just a second. One of the things that happened over the last number of years is an extraordinary blooming of government debt. The amount of money that we have outstanding. When I was young in my career, we'd look around at countries and try to find out which countries are good countries, bad countries from a balance sheet standpoint. And we'd look at things like debt to GDP, right? And we'd look at countries in Latin America, some in other areas of Eastern Europe, and say, oh, and even laugh during the great financial crisis about Greece and Italy and all that, right? And say, oh, look at these countries. They're 120, 150% of GDP to GDP. But the America, the United States, look at us. We're at 120% now.
122.95. I'm watching the debt clock.
Yeah. Is it ever going to impact us, or we just keep on just kicking the can down the road?
Well, look, I think nothing goes on forever. And even though we've been able to get away with this because we have the reserve currency status of the US dollar, I don't think that this is a permanent construct. I don't think that this is something that we can, I take my hat off to Treasury Secretary Bessent for saying we're going to extend out the maturity of U.S. Treasuries so that we can not be in such a precarious place going forward where we're relying too much on short-term debt. Now, he did not follow through with that with the first refunding announcement. We'll see what happens next quarter. But no, I think that there are definitely limitations and that the rest of the world is watching and watching very closely. You don't say you want to cut federal spending out of one side of your mouth and say that you want for there to be the debt ceiling completely removed. It's either one or the other.
Yeah, but that's the world we live in, right? The world we live in is that they want to cut taxes, but yet they want to cut spending. And, they're looking at adding tariffs to offset this or that and going possibly even to a no tax scenario where we just have a consumption tax. I mean, that's what's being talked about. That I can't imagine that happening.
Well, those are tariffs, aren't they?
Yeah, that's what they are, essentially. Yep. Just tariff everything, across the board tariff. And then it just equalizes everything because we're going to get tariff back. And then prices go up. And tariffs are inflationary. Oh, I'll ask you this. No, I'm not going to state that as a point. I'm going to ask you, are tariffs inflationary?
Well, the answer is initially going back to the 2018, 2019 playbook, tariffs were not inflationary as much as they slowed growth. And when you are part of a global trade, a cog in the global trade wheel, and global trade gets slammed, you're going to see a slowdown in growth. And that's exactly why the Federal Reserve released its 2019 FOMC transcripts the same day that they met and released the statement. And that episode goes through the history of what happened in 2019. And it was much more a situation of people are losing their jobs, the economy is slowing. And that was the bigger problem, because tariffs, it depends on how they're rolled out. If it's death by a thousand cuts, and it's a certain percentage point every single month, one after another, then you can see the inflationary buildup. But if it's a one-time shock, they do not tend to be inflationary.
So how do you see that the Fed is going to have to interact with these tariffs if they actually stay on? Is that going to be a problem for them?
No, the Fed's going to be data dependent. And that at least I take them at their word for. They're going to wait and see how the tariffs play out in the data and act accordingly. So they're not going to be preemptive. Not certainly when you've got continuing jobless claims at the highest level since November of 2021. You have to bear in mind both sides of the economy, the inflationary aspects, and there's nothing more deflationary than losing your job, because then you can't afford anything.
What would you do differently if you were in charge?
In charge of what?
I don't know. I'll give you in charge of everything, but let's just start with the Fed.
Well, look, I think the Fed right now needs to be a lot more communicative and acknowledge, instead of saying, you know, layoffs are very low, I think they should recognize that headcount has decreased appreciably through layoffs and attrition. Mm-hmm. And say to the American people, we are going to try and make your life easier by lowering interest rates, because we see that we are failing on our inflation mandate. And good luck getting them to say that. But I think that they need to be clearer with the American people about how difficult it is. I go back to what I said before. If you have a job, don't lose a job, because if you do lose a job, it's really hard to get another one.
So do you think the Fed is almost paralyzed because of their past multiple mistakes? They're just afraid to do anything different and change up? Or is it just that they realize it's a giant ship that turns very slowly and we'll just act accordingly?
Well, that's part of what's happening. But I think that right now communication is a real challenge at the Fed, because there are so many different schools of thought, even among the leadership. There's so much disagreement. And, you know, you've got individuals who are saying, but wait a minute, these revisions to job numbers are gigantic. We're not talking about the same job market that we thought we were talking about. And you've got some people who are leaning back on models that suggest inflation is higher than what it actually is on the ground. So there's a lot of dissension in the Fed right now. That's why the statement, when it was first released at 2:00 p.m. Eastern on January 31st from the Fed, appeared to be very hawkish and suggest that the Fed was not making forward progress on its fight against inflation. And then Jay Powell takes to the podium and swats that away and says there was no signal in what was communicated in we didn't mean to convey a signal, that was just a little bit of tweaking to the language.
So I guess the idea that they have to be more accommodative because of the reality of the fact of these job situations you're describing, but yet be cognizant of the fact that if they do too much, we can be in an inflationary environment, particularly if tariffs are put on without any kind of other cost factors or changes in policy. And it seems to be a very difficult task right now, from what I can see. I'm in the camp, from what I could see, that it seems like inflation is not done with us yet. But you're shedding some light on the idea that there's some things lurking in the shadows that are going to pop up and be much more impactful to the inflation outlook over the next 6 months?
I'll just give you one example. Huge apartment company, Mid-American Apartment Communities, massive nationwide footprint. Their new move-in growth was negative 8.0%. That's called a falling rent. Hmm. And it, if you think about the you've got 2.3 million people who are continuing jobless claimants. They're not moving into a more expensive apartment. They're moving in with their parents, or they're making sure that they get a roommate because they don't have a job. So, or maybe they're not even applying for unemployment benefits and they're driving for Uber because they can't afford to live off of unemployment benefits. But what we're hearing from companies on the ground is we don't have pricing power. And when you don't have pricing power, that means that income is being impaired. And that's exactly what you're seeing from payroll withholding taxes only rising by 2.0% year over year. We're skirting with negative territory in terms of, and what I'm trying to say is we're skirting with incomes falling in this country, which is what you get to when you get to a critical mass of individuals who are not in the workforce.
Which is also 180 degrees different from what you're hearing from the stock market, from the companies that are making more money than they could ever imagine, beating, you know, 78% as usual, beating EPS so far this earnings season, and revenues are up and everything is just hunky-dory. Stock market's close to an all-time high, give or take a little bit. And everything's seemingly running on all cylinders. Much different story.
Well, but again, go back to why so many companies that are reporting are beating their estimates. It's because they're in cost-cutting mode right now, meaning we're firing people or people are choosing to leave by way of attrition, quote-unquote.
Quote-unquote, yeah. Quote.
So that's one of the reasons that they are protecting their margins. And then you've also got this gigantic presence of passive investing in the market. And that just passive investing is more than 50% of inflows into the U.S. stock market. And it doesn't care what the price of NVIDIA is, it's going to buy it. If I take money out of my paycheck twice a month and that flows into my 401k and my 401k's got an index fund in it, I'm going to buy the stock no matter what the price is. And that is a powerful force to contend with that we didn't have the same situation in 08 and 09.
I call that, by the way, the mechanics of the market. It is once the month starts, money goes into the market. It is a dollar cost averaging automation through 401ks, which, by the way, just as a point of reference, that when jobs are plentiful, that will continue to have that kind of flow. Now, even when jobs are less plentiful, they're going to still be flow, but less flow, right? That automation, that market, the mechanics of the market that creates that bedrock of automatic inflows on a regular basis will be volatile or will change dependent on the number of people that are working.
That's absolutely correct.
So you have less people working, that safety net of inflows dramatically changes.
And that is the biggest challenge right now. And the only challenge I can see over the horizon as the Federal Reserve lowers interest rates, because 40% of the stock market is owned by individuals who are over the age of 70. So they're relying on interest rates not falling. They're relying on getting what I heard on the radio a few days ago, 4.0% on your cash, lock it in for the next year.
Yep.
Well, a year ago it was 5.5%. That makes a difference. Every time the Fed lowers interest rates by 50 basis points, two rate cuts, that takes $61 billion of interest income out of the hands of retirees. And it only benefits corporate America by $27 billion in terms of the lower interest expense that they're having to shoulder. So the Fed's in between a rock and a hard place, because in 2001 and in 2007, the same baby boomers who owned 40% of the stock market, they were young enough at the time to say, you know what? My IRA just got slammed, but I'm young enough to stay in the workforce for another 10 years. Mm. Now the median age of a baby boomer is 70 years old. So they don't have that same physical wherewithal to stay in the stock market.
Yeah, their risk tolerance and their time horizon has unfortunately automated them out of the stock market.
It has.
Yeah, I got you. Any closing comments? I know we're going to have on the show notes for episode 907 over on thedisciplinedinvestor.com how to get in touch with Danielle and her firm and understand what's going on and her great stuff that she does. And you really, I mean, I see you on TV and I read about you all the time and, you know, you're doing great. I love it.
Well, thank you. You know, I'm on a mission of financial literacy. I will be for the rest of my career. Follow me on Twitter if you don't already, at DiMartino Booth. And we are running a promotion right now off of our annual daily, which is a great quick read. So come see me at dimartinobooth.substack.com. Love to have you on as a new feather reader.
That'd be great. Yeah, it's called The Feather, by the way. That's the main one. But yeah, we're going to have all that stuff also on there. So make it very easy for everybody to do. Thank you so much. I hope to see you. Maybe if you come down to Florida, maybe it's been a little time. We'll go out, find something fun to do out here.
Yeah. You know, it's starting to feel like Florida weather to me. Yes. So yes.
Yeah. It's beautiful down here. All right. Thanks so much. I'll see you soon.
Thanks. Take care.
Bye. Bye. And that's going to wrap it up for this edition, this episode of the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Please make sure to subscribe, tell your friends, tell your family, tell everybody that you know, shout it out from the street corners, lay out flyers. I don't care what you do, but make sure people know about the Disciplined Investor Podcast. Leave a rating, a reply, a comment on how you like things, and go over to thedisciplinedinvestor.com and, see all the things that we do over there. Also, you can listen to John C. Dvorak and myself on Tuesday evenings. Well, it's available either live at 9 p.m. or you can actually get it at every fine podcast place like YouTube or Amazon or Apple Podcasts or Spotify, and the list goes on. Wherever you get your podcast, we're there. Thanks so much for joining me this week and every week, and I'll see you again real soon. Nothing discussed in this podcast should be considered a recommendation to buy or sell any security. Past performance is no indication of future results. In addition, the information presented is not intended to be used as a sole basis of any investment decisions, nor should be construed as advice designed to meet the individual needs of any particular investor. Nothing herein constitutes legal, accounting, or tax advice, or individually tailored investment advice. Remember, investing involves substantial risk. Past performance is not a guarantee of future results, and a loss of original capital may occur. No one receiving or accessing this information should make any investment decision without first consulting his or her own personal financial advisor and conducting his or her own research and due diligence, including carefully reviewing any applicable prospectuses, press releases, reports, and other public filings of the issuer of any securities being considered. Please consider this for educational purposes only. As always, use your best judgment when investing. Horowitz & Company, Inc. is registered as an investment advisor with the state of Florida and conducts business in other states where it is properly registered or is excluded from registration requirements. Registration does not imply any level of skill or training. Advertisements are not related to the host or affiliates and are not considered recommendations by the host of the show or any affiliates of Horowitz & Company.